and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the show this week. My guest is Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. We'd love your questions for him. Call those in to 496-1999. Send an email to ask@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. How are you?
Stan, how are you today?
I'm all right. I want to know, now that this year's elections are over, do you feel like you're officially on the clock as soon as the previous election is done, since you know you're running for next year's race? Are you, like, mentally preparing, or do you get a break from all of the election madness for a little while?
No, it's kind of ironic that you would bring that up. I mean, we talked about that absolutely. Once Tuesday was done, Wednesday is our first day of our campaign. That is the way we look at it. And in fact, we started having some discussions about 3 months ago on the 2019 campaign. And, you know, quite honestly, we continue to raise funds the 4 years in between and prepare for that. So, no, it's the day after, you know, starts ours. It's that November to November window.
And one of the things we want to say to our listeners is that three of the four of you who are regular guests on this program, with the exception of Mayor McBarnes in Frankfort, are running for reelection. And we're going to tread a little bit carefully on that on this show, as I'm sure you understand and the others do too. But still lots and lots to ask you about running the day-to-day operations of all of your cities in the next year, because, of course, you're all still mayors. And you still have those responsibilities. So just want to draw that distinction for our listeners before we go any further. Let's start with a listener question that came in from Lindsay, who says, are there any plans to improve the sidewalks in areas where students walk to school daily? She says, I walk to work at Tecumseh Junior High School and see a lot of kids who walk to school showing up in mud-spattered clothing due to the poor condition of the sidewalks and the drainage issues where cars hit puddles next to the sidewalks. She says, I encourage you to walk a mile on a rainy day to one of our local schools, as many students are required to do. As a recent transplant to Lafayette, Lindsay says, I'm also surprised at the lack of sidewalks in some areas, especially along Teal Road toward the mall. She says, this is driven home when I see areas of the city with lovely sidewalks that are rarely used, like East McCarty. And she ends by saying, better sidewalks would encourage a healthy lifestyle and improve safety for our young residents. Thanks for your consideration.
Well, first of all, I mean, there's a couple aspects to the question. We appreciate the question. One, Teal Road is not a city street, so that's a state highway. And so we are hoping, and there are sections of Teal Road when the state begins to rebuild that next year, that will get sidewalks. Not all of it, but a lot of it will get some sidewalks. So hopefully that will help. As far as the condition of the sidewalks goes, certainly we can take a look at that. But the reality is, since 1971, the maintenance of the sidewalks are the homeowner's responsibility. Once they're originally put in, going forward, if you read our city ordinance, and like I said, I know at least back to 71 and maybe before, that's the way it's been. That's the responsibility of the homeowner to put in. In CDBG areas, low to moderate income areas, we do get some funds every year to help with sidewalks if an area qualifies, but that's about $300,000 a year, which just does a few blocks, and there's still a partial payment required unless your income is so low that you fall below the threshold where you have to participate in replacing those sidewalks at all. And so typically what we do, if people call in and they have those concerns and it's a place that really is bad, then our engineer's office will send a notice to that homeowner and give them a certain amount of time to come up with a corrective action for those sidewalks. So a lot of places you might look and see where there's no sidewalks at all. There was a time many, many years ago where developers and people that build homes were not required to put sidewalks in. Everybody is required to put sidewalks in now. And so that's, as you see areas develop and you see places where there are sidewalks, you know, several years ago that was changed, where everybody's got to put in sidewalks now. You got to put in handicap ramps at the corners. You've probably seen the city over the last several years putting in numerous handicap ramps on big corners where there weren't before, and we're actually paying for all that and going back through and trying to get all those corners with handicap ramps where people weren't required to put in handicap ramps several years ago. So I'll certainly take a look out by Tecumseh. I'm out in almost all the schools on a regular basis doing different things, and we'll take a look. And if there are homeowners that we need to notify about the condition of sidewalks along there, we certainly will. And if there are drainage issues, I'm assuming she's probably talking along 18th Street. We'll certainly keep an eye on that during the next large rain and see where those might be, if it's actually a drainage issue or if it's just there's leaves and sticks that, you know, wash down in there, and there's inlets that are full that need to be cleaned out.
I admit that's a rule I didn't know about, that homeowners are responsible for the sidewalks in front of their property. It seems like a sort of odd way to do it. It's kind of a piecemeal way to do it, a few feet at a time, by according to the property lines, rather than having a unified way that you would address, for instance, the streets themselves. So you're talking about, you know, where do the cars go versus where do the people go, and how do you address each of those thoroughfares? Is that something the city did deliberately? Is that something you look at changing? Because it seems like an inefficient way to do it.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but it's the only financial way to do it. I mean, there. I don't know any community that could possibly. If you went through and the city was responsible for all the streets, all the curbs, and all the handicap ramps, which we do all of those, and all of the sidewalks, I mean, you're talking $200 million. I mean, there is no possible way with property tax caps. There's no funding source for special funding source for sidewalks except what you get a little bit for CDBG, and that's, like I said, not very much. There is no way they could possibly keep all the sidewalks up in a community. There's just no funding source to do that. And so years ago, most communities saw that coming, and so, you know, it became the property owner's responsibility as part of your home maintenance. And it's kind of a generational thing. You know, people, the older generation, they're used to it. They know their sidewalks are their responsibility, and they plan that thing as they home maintenance. They put money aside. But over time, you're right, a lot of people have kind of lost track that, you know, sidewalk maintenance is part of your home maintenance. And even when the city does some of the curb work, we'll even do the first driveway approach to help people up to the sidewalk. We don't do your driveway or the sidewalk, but we'll do the driveway approach up to the sidewalk to try to help out. But, I mean, there's just, you know, just think about every sidewalk in this city, how it, and all the roads and all the curbs. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Sure, but at the same time, just to play devil's advocate, it's not like you have to replace them all at once.
Well, there are a lot of them that would need to be replaced every year. And so it would be, if you figure about 300, depending on if you do how many handicap ramps and stuff, if you've got $300,000, depending on what you got to do, that might get you six blocks.
Okay. Well, it's good to know. It's good to have that economic mindset and that calculus in your head. This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA, talking today with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rozworski. You can call in your questions at 496-1999 or email us ask@wbaa.org. Let's talk a little bit about the elections that wrapped up this week. Your party won, I think, what was a couple of surprising races in some cases. I don't know that a lot of people expected Bob Goldsmith to beat Jason Domkowski in the sheriff's race, and I'd like to start there, because I think this was a surprise. Jason Domkowski had the primary, not only that, but he already had a name recognition advantage and a campaign organization advantage over Mr. Goldsmith, and yet that didn't seem to make that big of a difference in what happened. What's your opinion of how that all transpired?
Well, you know, first of all, it was a professional race, I think, where both candidates conducted themselves well, and the people in the community, because of that, got to hear where they stood on issues and their ideas and what they wanted to do at the sheriff's department, and I think that that's good. There wasn't a whole lot of difference between some of the ideas that they had and the direction that they wanted to take the sheriff's department. And I'll, you know, give Bob credit. He got out there and he worked very, very hard. He did a lot of boots on the ground type activities, and he got his message out. And then, you know, I think being on the sheriff's department for many years, being active in the community, and you know, he got out there and got his message out and was able to make that connection with, you know, you're just asking, this is just my opinion, right? You're able to make that connection with voters, that kind of personal connection that resonated. And because that has not happened in literally decades. I can't even remember the last time that there was a Democrat sheriff. And he got out there. He worked very hard. You know, he I know his heart and soul was into it, and he had a great passion for it. And he went out and convinced people that he had the ability to lead.
As your city and the county continue to fight a drug crime problem, one of the suggestions that Chief Domkowski had made was to lock up more drug offenders, treat them when they were in jail. I know that turned some people off, people who have been talking to you. I know about the needle exchange and other ways of trying to go about talking about the ancillary effects of the drug crime problem. What do you want to see Sheriff-elect Goldsmith do to try to help you out as your police force continues to fight drug crime?
Well, a couple things. I mean, I don't know that there's plenty of people in jail for drug-related offenses, so I don't know that we need to, and we always, as I've said before, there's three prongs to it. There's education, there's treatment, and there's enforcement, and we do have to do all of them. But the first thing I'd like to see is a true, and I think both candidates did talk about a true treatment program in the jail, a true treatment program that somebody gets brought in, and it don't have to be brought in necessarily for a drug offense. They could have got arrested for burglary, but they have a drug habit. We need to identify those people, and we need to do the best we can to quickly get them engaged in treatment programs that work. And there are a couple of them. A couple years ago in Indianapolis, I went to a forum, and I think both candidates talked about it. We need to quit talking about that and really get that implemented, because we need to get that treatment piece in there. And then, you know, there's some talking, and I've talked to our chief about it, and, you know, we are looking at how do we put together, is there a way on low-level people that are addicted, that are users, that aren't dealers, you know, can we have a program in place that as we interact with them on the street, instead of having to arrest them, can we get them into treatment? Can we get them into help that we think there's a possibility, and they're willing and they want to? So I'd like to see the community as a whole, you know, work on that direction while we continue to do everything we can with our drug task force and our street crimes unit to stop the flow of drugs into the community, with our interdiction unit, people that want to deal, that want to sell, that want to use drugs to harm other people. We must be vigilant on that, and we're committed to that. And then, you know, we'd love to see the county get involved in the drug task force. For several years now, they have not assigned any personnel to the actual countywide drug task force, and I would really like to see them assign somebody.
You could use some manpower.
And we've added people to it, so we could use additional manpower, but also the communication, right? If you have members directly from their department working on the task force, even though we all communicate well here and we get along well, it will still help information get back to the sheriff's department, because if you think there's not drugs in the rural area, if you think there's not drugs in the outlying area, then we've just got our head buried in the sand. And having that interaction between actual deputies on the task force, back with the sheriff's deputies that are out on patrol, them getting to know more what the task force is doing, information that we receive that can be easily disseminated then through the departments, I think would be a big plus. And so, you know, I'd love to see them get back engaged in the drug task force.
One of the other kind of surprising outcomes, less surprising I would say than the sheriff, is that Chris Campbell beat Sally Segrist in the Statehouse District 26 race. And so now you've got two Democrats representing you in the House from Greater Lafayette for the first time in about a decade. And I wondered what that does to your ability as a mayor to lobby for the priorities that you have at the State House as we get into the budget session, which starts in January. Does it make a difference that you've got two people in your party who you can say, hey, I need you to be my advocate down there? Does that help you? Does that, or the, let me, a devil's advocate to myself, does it hurt you to not have a bipartisan delegation from Greater Lafayette who can work on things and try to convince people from both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, I mean, what it's nice around here is, you know, we've always had good relationships with our legislators in the House and in the Senate about taking things down there that are important to Tippecanoe County and important to the community here as a whole and to Lafayette. And so, you know, we want to continue that dialogue and be able to do that and have that open line of communication. So I very much hope that does continue, because right now we can easily call our legislators on both parties, either side, and talk to them about things that are important to them, and a lot of times do joint meetings. And I think it's, you know, because what happens typically, and I'm going to divert just a little bit, is, you know, a lot of things start at the State House. It's not good for our area that didn't start in our area, but they start somewhere else in the state. And so a lot of times it's also, you need real advocates down there that are willing to stand up to either their party or the other party or Unifor and say, hey, not just get something through, but get something killed, that this is bad for our community. And, you know, we have things working well up here, and you know, I know over here they've had a problem, but don't punish the whole state because something didn't work well here in some other part of the state. And, you know, a lot of times it's also getting bad legislation stopped that would, you know, you can almost get punished sometimes when you work together really, really well with legislation from parts of somewhere else that they've had a problem. So they come up with a solution they think for that, which would actually make it harder here for do the things cooperatively that we do. So we need our legislatures to help pass good legislation, but we also need them to help kill bad legislation.
You've described yourself on this program as a more conservative Democrat, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about that, because you've got now probably Chris Campbell, who got elected, probably Alana Stonebreaker, who got elected to the county council, who are a little bit to the left of you politically, probably. And so I'm wondering, what does that dynamic look like, do you think? Is it possible that they will advocate things that they might want you to get behind that you might have some reservations about going too far left on?
Oh, well, that's always possible, because I'm certainly, you know, I've been the mayor for the past 15 years, city councilman, and also a 21-year retired police captain. So, you know, people know me well in the community, and they know what I believe. And, you know, I'm an operational guy. I'm not a big policy guy. I like to build roads and parks and baseball stadiums and get projects done, work on economic development. And so, you know, I think people are well aware. But, you know, I'm always open to listening. I think, you know, our party does have a big tent, and I think that's important, that we're inclusive, that we listen to people, and you know, so I'm always going to be open to listen. But I you know, you've said, I won't be shy about saying, hey, that's just too far to the left for me, and if you're going to pursue that, I respect that you have those beliefs, but that's not something that I'll get behind, and I'll be very upfront with them, and I'll be very upfront with the community. I won't hide it, and I won't be wishy-washy about it.
And, of course, what we saw in the Senate race was interesting in that same vein. Joe Donnelly tried to position himself as a very centrist guy, including, I mean, he even ran television ads trying to court moderate to Republican voters, saying, look, I will vote for a border wall, which I think might have been too far for some Democrats. He was a moderate. You're a relatively moderate guy who works with both sides of the aisle as well. But does the Democratic Party in Indiana have a problem with the idea of whether people are progressive enough? Is it becoming harder to know who you're talking to, harder to know how to kind of tread that middle ground as a Democrat?
Well, I mean, if I don't know on the state level. If you look at the local level, then I'll comment about the state. I mean, you know, I still think around here people are very open to voting for the person and voting for the person that gets results. I don't know that it's quite as, you know, the philosophy matters quite as much, because, you know, Tippecanoe County, I do think the demographics are changing. But the reality is a lot of Republicans had to cross over to vote for Bob Goldsmith. I mean, that's just reality. And I think, you know, we have two people on the county council. That's the same way. And so I think around here, and then we have Democrats that vote for Republicans. At the end of the day, in this area, I think people vote for the people that they think are going to help achieve results. And
it was somewhat remarkable, as I was looking at election returns the other night, the parity between the two parties. There were quite a number of Republicans elected. There were quite a number of Democrats elected. And frankly, as you were looking at things like the returns for the U.S. Senate race, what was happening there was the rural red counties were going solidly for Mike Braun. The urban blue counties were going solidly for Joe Donnelly. And what was happening in their local races was very much that same thing. There's not a lot of counties that have that split where people vote one way for one race and another way for the other race. This makes Tippecanoe County an outlier in some respects.
Because, I mean, Joe Donnelly won Tippecanoe County, at least the last time I checked the numbers, barely.
Yeah.
But he did win. But I think it's to your point, right? I mean, he did win in Tippecanoe County. And so, you know, I think that's the way people are in there. And that's, you know, I've said it before, that's my most important focus. I don't have any desire to hold any other elective office other than mayor of the city of Lafayette. And so I'm going to keep working and doing the right things for people. And, you know, it's still those dinner table issues. It's that grocery aisle issues when you're standing in the grocery store or sitting at a ball game, and that people care about, and the day-to-day services that we provide.
One of my reporters who lives in downtown Lafayette brought to me a flyer this morning that she had gotten, and it was explaining that Greater Lafayette Commerce has asked the city's Board of Works to shut down about a dozen downtown streets for the annual Christmas parade, as well as asking downtown residents not to actually park near their residences. It says that cars will be even moved, not impounded, but moved, as the prep for the parade happens, and then the parade itself for about 2.5 hours at the beginning of December. That seems like, I have to say, it seems like quite an imposition on downtown residents, isn't it?
Well, you know, we do it once a year, and I can tell you that, I mean, it's been the same way for as long as I can remember. We close the streets over in the historic Jeff neighborhood, primarily from 10th Street, from about Main Street over to just about Union, 10th up to about 13th Street there, Erie Street right in there, and we line the floats up. We kind of zigzag them back and forth. We line the bands up, the horses, all the cars, and then we funnel them out onto Main Street and make that turn there at 11th and Main and come down Main. And then, of course, we do ask people to get the cars off Main Street because the parade comes down. People sit there and stuff. And so is it an imposition? Yes, and we appreciate people's patience. But if you want to have a parade and you want to have almost 200 floats, 200 entries, you've got to have a staging area to stage them all where they park, and we got to do it. A lot of them are kids, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts, bands, little kids. I mean, so we've got to keep the street safe while they're standing there with their floats and their little decorations and stuff, or they're doing their dances before we bring them down Main Street. So we appreciate everybody's patience, but we hope they come out and enjoy the Christmas parade.
In the last couple of years on this show, we've had one or two people write in with comments about the Christmas parade, whether it's about the cold weather, which of course you can't control too much other than looking at where it goes on the calendar, and the timing, you know, where in the evening does it happen, how early or late does it start. How have you been looking at the comments you've gotten back, not just on this show obviously, but elsewhere too, about how, if at all, to change the way you do the Christmas parade?
Well, you know, we moved it from the afternoon to back to the evening, and you know, that seems to be for the most part well received. And you know, people like seeing them at night, and they're lit up, and it just is a little bit different than it has been in the past to bring a new feel to it. And so far, I mean, overwhelmingly, people have told me that they enjoy that. And we also, you know, we have to time it. We try so we don't hinder the Purdue music show and what they got to do. And then, you know, we try to do it differently now too with Dickens of the Christmas, listening to our downtown merchants on what day we do that. And then we're actually doing the free movie of the Polar Express on a different day. So we have juggled things a little bit to try to make downtown as lively as we can for different people, different age groups at different times, to bring as many people downtown and have some neat opportunities as possible. I'm sure not everybody's totally happy. I don't know there's a way to do that. It would just work perfect for everybody. But I feel pretty good that we're coming up with that combination that's good for downtown businesses, good for people, and works well as best we can.
I want to ask you to put on your former police officer hat for a second for me, if you would. There was a meeting this morning at a synagogue in West Lafayette talking about what the community can do in light of the tragedy in Pittsburgh of a couple of weekends ago. And, of course, we don't have to look more than 24 hours ago to see the mass shooting in California, unfortunately. And one of the things that I noticed that we're finding out is that the perpetrators of these events have in many cases left a kind of electronic trail of breadcrumbs saying they're going to do something or spewing hate speech or talking about violent acts. Is there any way that a police force like yours could ever say, attach a single person or a small team of people to looking at the folks just in this community? Obviously, you can't look at the entire country, but is there any way you could use the computing power that's available, especially when you consider you've got a major research university here with supercomputers, where you could try and be a little bit electronically proactive in that way to see if there's any of these signs that it seems like all too often now we as a society don't find until after something bad has happened?
Well, you know, it all depends. Well, first of all, I should say that, you know, we do have a group of police officers from various departments and Purdue University. And about a year and a half ago, there was actually the grand opening of the new facility over at Purdue in the basement over there, or the lower floor of one of the buildings, that do just that when it comes to child predators, pedophiles, people soliciting children. We do have people that are using computer science, working with Purdue, people that aren't law enforcement, working with our law enforcement to try to detect those people and protect our children. It's a monumentous, it's a large task trying just to do that, to track down, you know, people. But there are some cues and some things that happen in that world that can alert us to different things. And we have a group of people that work diligently. They do great work, and they do some other electronic works with cell phones and computers and things that we are able to confiscate. And so we do that. The challenge is, you know, even on a just doing it in this, let's just say Tippecanoe County, we did a joint task force. People have Twitter accounts and Facebook pages. There are some privacy issues on certain things. I'm not saying that it's a bad idea at all. I'm just saying
We are finding that some of these posts are on, you know, public message boards or public Facebook pages, which you know, you're not infringing on anybody if they've made the information public.
You know, and I'm not telling you that people don't ever do some of that already based on if they get some information that leads us in a direction. I guess the challenge is, you know, if you don't have any thing pointing to someone at all, you know, how do you just start the general scanning of the entire public in your community of Facebook pages? So we really do need the community to help us, to at least guide us. And I can tell you, our detectives look at Facebook pages. They look at Twitter accounts. They do look at what people post. I'm not going to sit here and tell you they scan everybody in the community, because they don't. But they do use those types of investigative techniques when we get leads, or when we can use it as supplemental information on criminal investigations. And I'm sure at some point there'll be systems and software out there that will help us do that faster and quicker.
All right, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time. We've run out of the show, but let's look forward to doing it again in December.
Thanks, Dan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can find this program archived at our website, WBAA.org. Tune in at this time next week for our conversation with Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes. If you've got a question for him or any of our other mayors, email that at any time to ask@WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.